And that's where I start with today's lecture, which has this very interesting word, aphthiton, meaning unwilting, as the key word to be thinking with and about. Aphthiton, unwilting, as in the expression kleros aphthiton, which is used by Achilles himself, the number one hero of the Iliad, in referring to his destiny for immortalization. And it's no accident that aphthiton, the root of aphthiton, is built into the name of his homeland, which means something like the place where plants wilt. I'd like you to think for a minute about how different stories, different versions of stories, begin and end. When you look at Achilles in this epic called the Song of the Ethiopians, which we have only in outline form from the ancient world, that's why the source book reference is to a single page. When you look at Achilles as the star of that epic, and you compare Achilles as the star of the Iliad, you'll see that they're very different endings. In the Aethiopis, the Song of the Ethiopians, he dies all right. He's on his funeral pyre. The funeral pyre is about to be lit, but then guess what happens? He becomes transported to another world that's removed from our world in both time and space, a paradise-like world where, after his death, he can become immortalized and then be an immortal person forever and ever. And when you think about the happy ending in the Song of the Ethiopians, and the sad ending in the Iliad, one thing I'd like people to compare is, and I've alluded to this before, for example, the narrative about Christ in Christian traditions, that if you look at a song culture version of the narrative of Christ, for example, the way Handel put together the Messiah, even though it's technically based on the book of Isaiah rather than the New Testament, it has a happy ending, doesn't it? It has a triumphalist closure with the resurrection of Christ being the point of finishing the narrative. Compare that with, let's say, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, which has these beautiful words of lamentation that I quote for you in that clip that starts with those few seconds from the film Casino. In the St. Matthew Passion by Bach, the way the narrative ends, so to speak, is with the death of Christ and with lamentation over his corpse by the mother and by the community at large. And for us in our classicist song culture, we have no problems with reconciling the narrative of, let's say, the Messiah with the St. Matthew Passion. And yet, when you think of it, the narrative is so different because of how you choose to round out the narrative, where you choose to stop in the narrative. And the key word for today, the idea of a song that is unwilting, I think will help us focus on what makes the Iliad, even though it's very pessimistic and with the way it ends the story, how the Iliad still has a very upbeat a message, even though that message is not something that you can read simply from getting to the end of the narrative. So stay tuned. For the purpose of my analysis today, it's handy to bring in some terminology from Prague school linguistics. And the terminology is unmarked versus marked. And I give you some examples here. When you have an opposition like this, the unmarked member can include the marked member. So, for example, when you go to a hardware store and you want to get a length of rope, and you're being asked, well, how long do you want the rope? Is it 8 feet or 10 feet? The long does not predispose you to whether it's long or short. So you say long is unmarked. If you're being asked, well, how short do you want the rope, then you know it's going to be short. And then look at the example of night and day, where day can include night, but night does not include day. I've got another one. Let's use a gender example, lion and lioness, which would be unmarked and which would be marked. I suggest to you that lion is unmarked, because when you say lion, you're not thinking of the gender of the animal. When you say lioness, you are thinking of the gender of the animal. And yet when you say, well, all lions roar, then in a sense the gender question doesn't come up at all, right? And to show you that it doesn't have to be the male that's unmarked, think about duck and drake. And this time it's the masculine that's marked, the feminine that's unmarked. And you don't have to worry about saying Donald Drake. It's okay to say Donald Duck, and everybody understands. And so I come to one of the most interesting cultural oppositions in the ancient world. And in a sense, we've been exploring this ever since we saw the film Blade Runner, where there was such an obsession with this. Look at this distinction between natural and artificial, between nature and culture. And I'm asking you, well, which of these is unmarked and which of these is marked? Not as simple as with some of the other questions. And when I'm using the word culture, I'm also thinking of cult, as in the cult of heroes. And I'm deliberately using the word cult there because cult of heroes, the worship of heroes, this historical fact about the concept of the Greek heroes has everything to do with the opposition of natural and artificial, as we'll see in a minute. Number six, you could say that nature is unmarked because culture can be part of nature, as in the case of a garden or a plowed field or an orchard or a grove. But, number seven, we see something different from other marked, unmarked categories. Culture can make itself the unmarked member. In that case, culture contains nature. And the example I give is Golden Age, where when you imagine in the ancient Greek world a paradise-like situation where even leaves are golden, that's the Golden Age, you're still thinking in terms of leaves, right? So even when you're trying to deny nature, as I conclude in number seven, you have to do it in terms of nature. Can I go back to the example of lion and lioness? The only way I can make lion masculine is by saying always, over and over and over again, that's no lioness, that's the lion. If I don't deny that it's the lioness, lion cannot be masculine. And because you've seen in our Heroes Film Festival this very deep and provoking film by Kieślowski, I have to give you this quotation. I wish I hadn't made a typo, but it should be basic. He says, Kieślowski does, we used one fairly basic filter in Véronique, a golden yellow one. Thanks to it, the world of Véronique is complete. It's whole. And isn't it ironic that your professor forgot to put a period after complete? Here I'm obsessed with completion, with coming full circle, and I forget the period to kick myself. Number eight, we come to a very interesting study in contrasts. Essentially, as you're reading these two very short pieces of ancient Greek poetry, the Homeric hymn to Demeter, the goddess of vegetables and vegetation and seasons, and the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite, you will see again and again the theme, number eight, of cultural immortalization. And in the case of the Homeric hymn to Demeter, it has to do with an athletic festival that, as we now know, happens on a seasonally recurring basis, on an anniversary date, year after year after year, forever and ever. And how such an athletic festival, ideologically, from the point of view of the ancient Greeks, is meant to make up for the prototypical death of a hero. A death that's so enormous in scope and in ramifications that you can never make up for it with any one athletic festival. You have to keep recycling those athletic festivals on a seasonally recurring basis forever. How ironic that the life of a hero is so unseasonal until the moment of death. And then you have to do this seasonal compensation forever and ever. So that's number one. Number two, the institution of a dynasty that lasts forever. And that's what the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite is all about. Aphrodite is not only the goddess of sex, she's the goddess of regeneration, which means that she's the principle that makes it possible for a family's genes to last forever and ever and ever, for every parent to have a child and for that child to be the parent of a next generation of children, and so on and so on and so on, forever and ever. The idea of an eternal dynasty, this obsessive idea in ancient Greek song culture, is presided over by the goddess of love and sex, Aphrodite. And then three, what I'm going to do at the end of this lecture is tie in the institution of epic poetry itself, which as a cultural creation is designed to remember your glory forever and ever and ever. Number nine, I give you the precise wording in the Homeric hymn to Demeter for the way in which the baby hero, because as you'll see from this poem, heroes can be babies, they don't have to be adults. The way the baby hero, although he dies, will have a compensation, a consolation prize of something that will last forever, and that forever will be the athletic festival. And in number nine, I give you the precise wording, thymē ostikos, an honor that is unwilting, so it's unwilting like a beautiful flower. And as you'll see, when you look this up, the specific passage, and I give it to you in number nine, the athletic festival happens at the right hora, at the right season, forever and ever and ever. Every time the anniversary happens, the athletic festival takes place, and that will make up for the death of the baby. And it's presided over by the goddess of vegetation, the goddess of flowers, the goddess of everything that the earth produces, Demeter, which means earth mother. Number 10, I'll give you a parallel from modern times. Let me read this. John Lennon's widow, Yoko Ono, held a press conference to unveil plans for a small Central Park site to be renamed Strawberry Fields in honor of one of Lennon's great hit songs. She said 31 nations responded to her appeal to send their native plants and stones to make the site, quote, a garden of love, an island in which all nations could grow together in harmony, unquote. And then I love this banal, it's so American edition. In addition, NASA, NASA sent a seedling germinated in outer space. Well, look at the emphasis of Yoko on the concept of an island, something that is shut off from the rest of the world, an enclosure. And I will want you to compare that with this mystical concept for heroes after they die and after they're immortalized, which is the islands of the blessed. This is what in Iranian traditions is called paradesos, which means paradise for us. For the Iranian mentality and Jewish mentality that inherited this concept, it's the walled enclosure that walls off something. And I say to you, number 11, that the ancient concept is that an enclosure, this kind of enclosure, keeps out the hostile aspects of nature, of wilderness. And I find it ironic that for us moderns, when you close off a space, it's not that you want to close off hostile forces of nature which are on the outside, it's just the opposite. As I say here, for us moderns, paradise needs an enclosure that keeps out the hostile aspects of culture, of technology, of the way technology can destroy nature, as in the case of wildlife preserves. Think of the word preserve and the concept of wildlife preserve. And compare, for that matter, in the first film we saw, that nostalgia that the future generations will have for real, authentic life in real, authentic, supposedly, nature. Number 12, if you flip the page, one of my biggest arguments, and this has stemmed from research that I've been doing for over 25 years, is that contrary to popular belief, Hades, the place where the psuchai of heroes go after they die, is transitional. It's not where you wind up, it's where you go through. And by contrast, places like the Islands of the Blessed, Elysium, Ethiopia, are eschatological. And eschatological means, in Greek theological terms, where you wind up. For example, you can say that in Christian eschatology, you end up in heaven or hell. And purgatory, let's say, is a transition. I'm suggesting to you, and I'm arguing strongly, that in the ancient Greek worldview, Hades is transitional. Now, in the Iliad, it doesn't look transitional, does it? It looks as if you wind up there. But stay tuned for further insights, and I think that's why it's very important to compare the Iliad with the Song of Ethiopia, the Aethiopis, even though we have it only in plot outline form. Now, Yancy, are you ready for my first one? Let me introduce this. I gave you a clip the other day of Jim Morrison courting his girlfriend Pamela, and they're having this interchange about what really means the most to each of them. There's a lot of equation of death and sex, which is typical for the Doors, for Jim Morrison. This is another beautiful illustration why I don't think Jim Morrison has anything to do as a person with the concept of the hero. I also think that the substance abuse that marked Morrison's life is why I can't see the whole movie. I just can't stand emotionally sitting through the movie because there's such self-destructiveness as you sit through it. What I didn't do the last time is I simply showed you this moment, this musical moment, where the song that is being sung in the background is one of Morrison's most famous songs. And yet he's saying to Pamela, this is for you, for this moment, for this time and place. What I didn't show you is what happens at the end of the movie, and so I'm going to make a different narrative today, just as there's a difference between, let's say, the St. Matthew Passion and the Messiah. Watch what happens if I show you this particular scene and then the very end of the movie. I know it's unethical to show people the end of the movie, but I'll do it. And look away if you can't stand seeing the end of the movie, okay? And you'll see a very different narrative. Because at the end, Jim Morrison has died from the very things that he's talking about at the beginning. And Pamela's saying, was it good for you, Jim? She's like a lamenting woman. And then you have a shot of Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris, which is where Morrison is buried. And there's a marker. Marker, get it from last lecture? There's a marker. This marker, the camera finds in a bumbling way. Wait till you see the camera work of Oliver Stone. The camera sort of bumbles into Père Lachaise Cemetery. You see some of the greatest composers of European song culture, including Bizet, including Sarah Bernhardt. There they are all buried, and the camera bumbles along, and then next thing you know, it zeroes in, as it were, on Jim's grave, and then listen to the song that is played. So let's do the whole ensemble. Yancy.
Now I have come again to the land of fair and strong and the wise. Brothers and sisters of the pale forest, oh, children of night, who among you will run with the hunt? Now night arrives with her purple legion. Retire now to your tents and dreams. Tomorrow we enter the town of my birth. I want to be ready. It's beautiful.
Like that?
It's beautiful. I've never read much poetry before. What's a shaman?
Medicine man. Indian. He gets into a peyote trance and he's deeper and deeper, and then he has a vision and the whole tribe is healed. All cultures have a version of it. Greeks have theater and gods. The Indians say the first shaman invented sex. They call him the one who makes you crazy. turns you on?
I don't know. Experience. Freedom. Love. Now, do you know that the first time I did acid, I saw God. And I saw a friend of mine who was Christ, but he was Judas too. You know, and then I realized that somehow that was the secret of everything. We're all one. The universe is one. And everything is beautiful.
I don't know. I feel most alive confronting death, experiencing pain.
I think you're most alive by recognizing beauty, seeing truth. Does death turn you on? Love death?
Life hurts a lot more. When you die, the pain's over. All the poems have holes in it, all but one. The most beautiful one of all. She dances in a ring of fire and throws off the challenge with a shot.
Beautiful.
Waiting to take him in the discovered garden. You know how pale and wanton the still feel from his death and his strange outer, and announced on Times War, the staring, over-friendly guest who brought the bait. Death makes angels of us all and gives us wings where we had shoulders smooth as raven's claws. The more money, the more fancy dress, other kingdom things might follow the death, until its other jaw reveals insect, and loose obedience to a vegetable law. I will not go. I prefer a feast of friends to the journey of family.
Why they're called boars? It's because Jim Morrison was fascinated with the work of Aldous Huxley about visual perception, and there's the Huxley book called The Doors of Perception. And I like the way the camera at the end of this narrative essentially perceives what Morrison is about all over again, even though it's very awkward and bumbling, as I say, and stumbles along, but in the end you have that frame. And that door of perception, so to speak, is what, as I remind you in Numbers 15 and 16, and 7 and 16a, is what Sappho's song-making is all about. In a sense, we cannot appreciate the composition and performance of Sappho's songs unless we understand that, again, what is being achieved is a window on an experience, on an intense human experience, especially in Sappho 31, And one of the things I hope you will be doing, because this course involves a lot of revisiting things that you've seen before, is look again at Sappho 31, that wedding song involving three people. Look at the way it begins, the very first line, and look at the way it ends. The first line is talking about this eternal bridegroom, because every time you hear the song, a bridegroom is getting married all over again. And her eyes are focusing on this bridegroom, and there's a word that she uses which seems to mean on the surface, he, the bridegroom, appears to me to be equal to the gods. But in the Greek, the word that we translate as appear is the word of epiphany. It's the word of divine vision. It's the word that designates what you see in your mind's eye when suddenly your doors of perception flash onto something that is immortal, eternal. It's that second that captures everything. What I liked about Muhammad Ali's statement about how you have to divide up the second into 100 parts, and when you have 1/100th of a second, that's how perceptive you have to be, that's how your doors of perception have to be set so that you can catch the vision of one of his punches. In that Sappho song, where you focus on the bridegroom, then you focus on the bride, then you self-focus on your feelings as you're contemplating this timeless or timelessly recurrent marriage or wedding. When you have that moment, as the last line of Sappho's song indicates, you seem to yourself to be just on the verge of death. That's what she says. I seem to myself to be just on the verge of death. And you guess that the word that she uses for I seem to myself is again the concept of epiphany, as I said to you in a previous lecture. In other words, it's a kind of auto-epiphany. It's like appearing to yourself as if suddenly your doors of perception flash on you and your sensations. In the process of contemplating this timeless wedding of the eternal bridegroom. One of the things that makes me so happy about a course like this is when one of you, one of the students, comes up with an insight that kind of flashes onto everything we're trying to capture. And I don't want to embarrass Paula, but when Paula mentioned in Kevin's section the theme from Dante where Achilles is described as the eternal bridegroom, I would say that's one of those flashes of intuition, and it's what makes it worthwhile for me to be teaching this course year after year, because it elicits from you, you sharp readers, all these refracted insights that no one person can achieve in entirety. And so that's why it's so important for us to be sharing our close reading and then sharing it through the art of writing essays incisively. But where I'm going to end up is how this image of the doomed bridegroom, the eternal bridegroom, is an image that you see in all sorts of different cultures. And if you look at number 17, maybe read it later in the privacy of your home, it tells about how Joe DiMaggio sort of tried to keep his love for Marilyn Monroe alive by having roses placed at her grave on a seasonally recurring basis. And then the big disappointment for us moderns is how one fine day the rose delivery was canceled. And that means especially a lot to me, because if I can be confessional, I proposed to Holly almost 25 years ago at Marilyn Monroe's grave, and she thought, oh, how romantic. And at that point, Joe DiMaggio's roses still kept coming. Then they stopped coming. And that's where I come back to the Homeric hymn to Demeter. That's where I come back to the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite. That's where I come back to the Iliad. Because this song culture that we're studying, it may be naive to us as we look back, but this song culture actually believed that once you have this kind of cultural compensation set up for the death of a hero, it really will last forever. That is to say, if there's going to be an athletic festival to make up for the death of the baby, this athletic festival will last forever and ever and ever. There's no question about it. if there's a dynasty that will last forever, there's no question about that. And then the most important part, if there is a song that is supposed to last forever, such as the Song of Achilles, the chorus that captures forever, that encapsulates forever the entire life and an experiential world of a hero, that will last forever. As I'm meditating on the concept of the eternal bridegroom, do you mind if I show you, I told you I'd show you something very vulgar, a case of somebody who was fancied to be the eternal bridegroom for millions and millions of women of America, and this was the king, Elvis. Elvis starred in a very bad movie called Spin Out, which is about race driving, and it's about taking left turns, which is why, for example, in your collection of clips, I have a clip of Ben-Hur, because if you really want to study how people take left turns in chariot races, you look at that clip in my collection on your website from Ben-Hur. Or you can suffer through the entire movie of Elvis called Spin Out. Luckily for you, I just have two very, very incisive moments. And what I want you to do after you see these clips, and I'm timing it so that Elvis's last words will be when today's lecture finishes, so it has to be just right. I want you to revisit these two clips on your website, because I have pages and pages of commentary tying it up with the Iliad, okay? I can't do it here, so just watch the clip. And the timing is everything.
Well, she must be some kid. $5,000. I'll have to see what she looks like. Any Brad could get her old man to pull a stunt like this.
Yeah, can I feel the check?
She's probably ugly. A rich, ugly girl. She better be.
Can I feel the check?
Mike, we're not going to let him get away with this.
What I should do is give him a good swift kick and watch it. I just show him who he's fooling with. Of course, if I did that, he'd probably mess up our whole tour, and we'd have to go back up there anyway. So it looks like our best bet is to sing the one song and get it over with.
Yeah, might as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Santa Barbara. Let's go.
I'm ready. I kind of like Santa Barbara.
I haven't seen you spying around lately.
Miss me?
Well, here it is again. Okay, fellas, restring your guitars, and I'll hit her with my snare drum.
How's the book going?
Finished. I sent it in yesterday. Which reminds me, shall we set a date?
A date for what?
My publisher has to send out announcements.
Your publisher?
He's always wanted a big church wedding. Besides, he thinks it'll help sell my new book.
Now, what are you talking about?
Mike, you've forgotten.
Forgotten what?
Didn't I tell you? You're my perfect man.
Oh, you don't know me very well.
Remember what I said I'd do when I found my perfect man?
Yeah. You said he'd get you.
That's right. And as soon as I domesticate you, get your house broken, you'll be the best husband a girl ever had.
Husband?
Over my dead body.
I'll see you around. Let's go.
Mike, I'm going to marry you.
Well, almost ready. I don't know how long I can keep Cynthia out of here.
She opened the rest of her presents yet?
Look, Mike, I'm sorry I had to use such high-pressure methods to get you here, but believe me, you won't regret it.
Now you're going to change my whole life, huh?
Maybe. I saw you win at Sebring last year. With a car that shouldn't even have been entered.
Sebring? What do you got on your mind?
I'm bringing out a new racing car, the Fox 5. How'd you like to drive it?
Look, mister, I'm here to do a song, and that's all. And as soon as I'm finished, I'm getting out of here. If I'm lucky, it's the last I'll ever see of you. Now, where's the birthday girl?
Here she is. Surprised?
Yeah.
Mike, sing something sweet.
Am I ready? can my heart be true? Am I ready to fall in love with you? One love, one girl, one dream shared by two. Am I ready to fall in love with you? I have touched your lips, and now I know I would be a fool to let you go. Should I, how I wish I knew, am I ready to fall in love with you? Should I, how I wish I knew, am I ready to fall in love with you? Fall in love.
All right, let's wrap it up and get out of here.
I told you this would be amazing, right? Now, because the timing was so good, let me just leave you with this thought. Read my comments on this clip, and then go back to the idea, the serious idea of the eternal bridegroom, and remember that in the Iliad, book 9, line 413, when Achilles says that he will have a Eros that will never wilt like a beautiful flower, the wonder of it all is that although hero cults are extinct, although dynasties are extinct, the one thing that has survived to this day, and we're experiencing it now, is the Song of Achilles. What Achilles prophesied in his own epic is still a reality, thanks to the fact that we can still read it. And it's a wonder to me, and I hope to you. Thank you.